Send your question or indeed your schmestion to correspondence@cobernmayer.com. Thank you for downloading. Here we go.
Question schmestions.
Beverly from Colne in Lancashire.
Okay.
It's quite a long
question,
but it boils down to one simple sentence. Anyway. Okay.
Good.
Says, many people are enthusiastic about films or music when young, but often as they get older, the enthusiasm wanes. I'm curious to know if either of you have had times in your life when you felt that you started to lose interest in or grow weary of the world of film or music. Do you ever feel the need to take a break from films or music when on holiday? Here's the, so this is a bit I've underlined. What is the longest period Mark has gone without watching a film since films have been his career?
Ooh.
My suggestion for a good double, okay, fine. So that's quite interesting. So first of all, I think, which is a kind of straightforward measurable thing, what do you think is the longest period you've gone without watching a film?
Well, it will almost certainly be if I've gone away on, so for example, I was away for 10 days away abroad. And
is that your recent? Just recently.
And I think in those, so I know for a fact that in those 10 days, I did not watch any movies.
On the plane?
No, I did watch a movie on the plane on the way out.
Do you feel withdrawal symptoms or were you twitching to come back?
No, I mean, I was very, you know, when I came back to the first National Press show, which then that would have been the first movie that I'd seen in 2 weeks, the first press show I'd seen in 2 weeks. I remember sitting down with a renewed sense of, you know, enthusiasm. But, I mean, the reason I didn't watch any movies was because I didn't take a laptop with me.
And there were lots of other things going on.
Yeah, and there was like, you know, lions and elephants and stuff. Yes. And that was good. So that's probably, so I would say probably the longest period I've ever gone for without watching them. Because obviously, you know, when Linda and I were going away when we were younger, we would have watched films on telly. When we got to America, we would have turned the telly on and watched the film. And then, so I think probably 10 days would probably be about it.
The slight more difficult one to answer is, have you ever grown weary?
No.
Of film?
No. No. And in fact, I made a promise that I, you know, it's like when I stepped down from the Observer thing, I said I would do 10 years. And then I did 10 years, exactly 10 years, exactly 10 years. And somebody said, oh, you know, well, well done for keeping to it. I went, well, that's the one thing I do. If I say I'm going to do something, I will do it. And I have said that if I ever get to the point of going into a screening and going, I'll stop. And
unless you know exactly what you're about to say.
No, I mean, just the idea of a screening in general. Yeah. And the reason I thought that was because a colleague whose work I respected greatly did, in the final years of their tenure, get to the point of going, and I thought, I don't ever want to do that.
My editor in Bookland at Transworld, Bill. He's, as you know, because you've had a number of hit books. The most exciting moment is when you get the first one, and maybe you'll get sent, like, it'll be in a thick envelope with just one copy.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a box, because your contract normally says you can have 12 copies or something like that. And that's the most, when you see all that work, years and years of work, all those words, and it's an actual thing that you can put on a shelf and you can hand out to people.
And then you open it and see the mistake.
Yeah. And then, but he said, if I ever lose the excitement of that moment, then it's time to stop. So there'll be
equivalence of
everyone listening in their job. If they ever think, oh, I'm going to have to do that again, then it's probably time to stop. But as far as I'm concerned, that's
in relation, because since you mentioned books, in relation to the music part of that question as well, because it said film and music.
I imagine that the film was aimed at you and music aimed at me, but I might be wrong.
Okay, well then I'll make my point in a moment. So you go, carry on, you were about to say.
I guess the answer to that is never, ever tired, because I can get weary of one particular type of music, so I'll start listening to a different type of music. The longest I've gone without listening to music would probably be a few hours.
Yeah.
I mean, never, ever has there been a day without listening to music. When I was doing speech all the time at Five Live, and it was speech, 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 I'd get in the car and listen to music. And when you work in music and you play music for a living, you often get in the car and put on speech. But I cannot imagine a single day without listening to music of some kind. because there is, you know, if you're fed up with the raucous stuff, then put on a bar chorale or something, you know. And if you're fed up with the choral stuff, then put on a bit of Savage Garden. No, don't put on Savage Garden. No, there. So there's lots of types of music and bands that you get fed up with, but then there's just something else to be a part of.
So that thing about, I struggle to think of a day that I haven't listened to music, because it's a slightly different thing watching film, because music, you can, you know, it's just...
You 5-10 minutes.
Exactly. Or and even if you were somewhere where there were no devices, the idea of going through a day and you're not even singing, you know, I don't think there has been a day that there hasn't been some form of music. In terms of the, do you get bored of it? As you said, it's just a matter of what you do. I mean, I'm not up with contemporary music at all, but I can still listen every single day to the albums that I loved and the old rockabilly, particularly the old sort of old blues, you know, washboard. I can listen to that endlessly, as indeed my father did. You know, his great joy, right through his life, right to the, you know, to the very end of his life, was you could put one of his favorite pieces of music on and it would transform him. He loved music, and that was marinated in me.
Here is again proof of the short question being slightly more challenging.
Okay,
from Shahil in Warwick. What is the biggest risk you've taken? Great question. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you could go around the office or go around your family or whatever. So, so you could do this professionally or you could do this personally, because I think you could say personally, getting married, having kids is quite a gamble. I mean, you're thinking on the basis of the evidence, I think this is going to be fine. The thing that occurred to me straight away was, I'm a Tottenham fan. And there was a Tottenham Arsenal derby. This is, you know, decades ago. And I didn't have a ticket. So I bought a ticket from a tout. But it was a ticket for the Arsenal end, as it turned out. So I think this is the biggest risk that I've taken. So as a Tottenham fan, I went and stood amongst the thousands of Arsenal supporters. This it was a game. It was at Tottenham. And I stood with the Arsenal as Tottenham won 2-0. But the first goal was scored...
Did you have to go, oh, well,
no,
boom.
The first goal was scored quite early and I swallowed it. And then the second goal was right at the end and I just went, yep. Which would show great control. But also the other thing that occurred to me was actually leaving Radio 1 and going to 5 Live was probably the biggest professional risk, because losing the music, just pertaining to our previous question, which everything revolves, whether it's classical music or jazz music or whatever, music radio has a certain structure. Going to 100% speech was terrifying, and that was a risk. Nicky Campbell made it a bit easier because he'd gone ahead and prepared the way. No, that
he
sounds
was Moses.
Messianic, doesn't it? He was John the Baptist, and I just no. But that's the scariest. So that was the scariest thing. So I think that was probably the biggest risk. What about you?
My first instinct was the thing that you said, which was having children. I don't mean the biggest risk because you think, you know, how will your children turn out? I mean the biggest risk because you don't know whether you're going to be any good as a parent. And the terrifying thing is the idea of bringing a child into the world and you being rubbish at being a parent. And I think everybody knows an email earlier on when somebody said they suddenly gave us this young baby to look after.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of Linda and I standing outside the Lymington maternity unit when we were leaving with child one, and Linda had been in for a while because there was some complications. But and then suddenly everything was done. And then it was like, okay, fine, now go. And we stood outside and somebody took a photograph of us. And then we went,
and next.
Having been surrounded by, you know, the cream of medical staff for however long it was. And then you go home and you go, So I do think I do consider that to be a huge risk. I think also in terms of the good lady professor, the biggest risk in her life was, you know, marrying me. And I hope it worked out all right. But, you know, it's like, because you're kind of making an assumption whenever anybody commits to a long-term relationship. I mean, from my point of view, it was never any question. It was like, well, you know, anyway. But I think when you're talking professionally, you said the thing about leaving Radio 1, weirdly enough, You know, I left Radio 1 a year before you did, and it wasn't like it was my day job, but I had a very good job at Radio 1. I was a film critic for Radio 1, and it was very good. And I left because I felt like it was time to go. And at the point that I left, they were still saying, please don't go. And my motto has always been, find the door before they show it to you. And this, a similar thing with The Observer, that I think when you're a freelancer and you walk away from any job, there is a risk involved. But I also believe absolutely deep in my waters, you know when it's time to go. And as soon as you have that feeling, go. So I think that I have done that a few times, and I've been lucky enough that it's worked out. I mean, largely it's worked out because I've just managed to just shackle my wagon to your particular star, and you haven't sunk without a trace. And as a result of that, I have a career. So that's been quite good. But that thing about leaving Radio 1, people did say to me, why are you leaving Radio 1? You've got a cushy job. You are literally broadcasting, you know. And I was like, yeah, but I'm now twice the age of the average listener and I need to go.
Carly in Worcester, have either of you ever experimented with facial hair? Jason Isaacs' moustaches don't count.
Yes, I've experimented with a beard, and I probably said this before, I can't grow a beard because when I was younger, very young, I fell out of a car and I fell on my face on the ground, and I've got a bunch of scars around my lips and my chin that hair doesn't grow on. So if I grow a beard, I look like the Team America World Police. So yes, I have experimented and it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I just can't.
Robbie Collin is rocking a moustache at the moment. Have you seen him recently?
He is
rocking a moustache.
I just
can't. It's kind of Freddie Mercury tash. It's very statementy.
You either look good or you don't look. It's like whether you look good in a hat or not. And I don't, so I don't. And I can't really grow a beard, so I don't.
Well, there we go. You can't grow a beard because
it's just pathetic.
Okay.
Eric in Aberdeen, what is the best gift you've received this year? Please don't say my grandchild or my child doing well at university or any of that schmaltz. We want actual gifts.
Actual physical gifts.
So,
wow.
At my last birthday, not the one that was just gone, but the one before that, I said to everyone who was inclined to get me a present, get me something that you've particularly liked.
Okay.
Just because I never come up with a meaningful list.
Yeah.
So I said, whatever it is you think is fantastic,
yeah,
get me one of those.
Okay.
Let's see if I can. Anyway, so in all of that, child three, who's into his comedy, took me to see a comedian called Glenn Moore, who I hadn't seen before, but in his assessment, I would really like. And he was absolutely right. And Glenn Moore was very funny. And I thought, good, okay, this would not have happened if I hadn't asked for a particular thing. And so it was a well-chosen gift. As far as a physical thing is concerned, I have a jacket down there, which the great redactor seems to have an identical jacket. So now I'm thinking I'm never going to wear it.
Can't go out together.
No, it's a French labourer's jacket. In fact, the label is laboureur.
Is it?
A chore jacket, apparently, it's called. It's a jacket for chores. Whenever I'm doing chores around the house, that often, I'm going to be... obviously, you put on a really kind of stiff jacket. Anyway, it's very nice. So it's very well chosen. What about you? So this is the best gift you've received this year. So let's say the last 12 months.
Okay, so I can tell you exactly what it is. Well, there are two... can I say two things?
Yeah.
Okay, they're both around my 60th birthday. One of them is... my very good friend Caroline, who is Ali's partner, Ali from the Dodgers, for my 60th birthday made, and the word made really doesn't even begin to describe the construction that went into this, a gingerbread birthday cake in the exact shape of the house from The Exorcist, including a man standing under a lamppost, which lights up, and a light inside the house, which shines a light. And if you've ever followed me on Instagram, but if you ever have, I put many, many photographs of this. This cake was a work of art.
It's kind of a shame to eat it, really.
Yeah, I know.
Did it get eaten?
What we did was we kept it preserved for as long as possible.
Till it was stale.
Till it was stale. But it was like, and when we had party, we had it up. I mean, it was the most majestic thing. So that was one. And the second thing is the good lady professor, her indoors, got me the best possible 60th birthday present, which is that... I don't know whether you know this, but I have size 14, 14 and a half feet, okay? So the reason...
Big plate to meet.
So the reason that I wear Daps the whole time is because it's very, you know, I wore Docs, but 14 and a half Docs are like clogs, you know, it's... And so I love shoes, but I can't wear them because my feet are so stupidly big. And when I was young, I used to wear brothel creepers and winkle pickers and all the rest of it. But I, you know... So the good lady professor, her indoors, for my birthday, gave me a thing, which is... there is a shoe shop in London, a bespoke old shoe shop that is like something out of Harry Potter. And it was a thing to go and get my feet measured, and then they make a mold of your foot, and then they make you a bespoke pair of shoes for your foot. And I'm currently halfway through the process. So I have been there, they have made a 3D model of my feet, my stupid feet, and they are now, I have to go back and then they do a kind of, you know, like a fitting thing. And it is fabulous because the idea of having a pair of shoes that actually fits my stupid feet, which I haven't had since my feet passed the 30, you know, nowadays you go into a shoe shop. Have you got anything in 14? No, we just do normal sizes.
I'm completely I'm at the other end. I'm size 7, so my feet are half the size of yours, and sometimes they don't even have them that small. No, we have normal
sizes. The
Clark
store is round the corner, sir.
Start at 8. Oh, you want women's shoes or children?
So yeah, but honestly, it was such a great gift because it's like the thought that went into it. You know, what troubles Mark the most? I know how I can fix that. So that was lovely.
Kat Wilson, on the subject of double bills, I thought I'd mention one of mine, not because it's a particularly good one to recommend, but because it led me to a question. You know, and also a longer running topic of witter, that of sneaking, chancing, or otherwise finding your way into films rated higher than your age.
Yes.
As a teenager, a film-loving friend and I used to go to the biggest multiplex cinema we could find, buy a ticket for an age-appropriate film,
yes,
probably head to the toilets, where we'd wait for the door attendant to be distracted and sneak into the film screening we really wanted to see.
Yes.
On this day in the mid-90s, the film ticket we bought was for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3.
Okay. And the film Secret of the Ooze, or is that 2?
And the film that we wanted to see, Interview with a Vampire. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the film start times didn't line up, so we watched another film first while waiting, and that film was Luc Besson's Leon.
Wow.
Now to my double bill question. On watching Leon, followed by Interview with a Vampire, mm-hmm. we were distinctly underwhelmed by the film that we had originally been excited to see.
Yes.
I rewatched Interview with a Vampire a few years later and enjoyed it much more,
okay.
making me aware of how strongly the viewing of Leon has shaped my perception of IWAV, as no one particularly calls it. This must be something that film critics regularly encounter. So I wonder, how do you account for that in your assessments and analysis of films? Because one might influence your enjoyment of another. And other than AI, are there films that you have reassessed later that you think were affected by the other films you have viewed them alongside?
Well, the double bill thing for me, second time to mention it in this show, is Jeremy, because Jeremy was a supporting feature with Breakheart Pass, the Charles Bronson film, and I can remember nothing about Breakheart Pass at all because I was so completely floored by Jeremy that I just watched Breakheart Pass in a fog. I think actually a fog that I wanted the film to work because I was so heartbroken by Jeremy. I've never gone back to Breakheart Pass again, and I couldn't give you any sensible account of it because I used to keep a notebook of films that I'd seen, and I don't think I wrote anything about Breakheart Pass. I think I only wrote about Jeremy. Critics don't tend to see double bills. You see three films, four films back to back, which isn't quite the same thing, but it is true that in any particular week or, you know, day of screenings, that it must be that the films sort of speak to each other. And the way in which you account for that is that you understand that all reactions to films are subjective, and they don't just have to do with what other film you saw. They have to do with, You know, sometimes you can be in a really, really great upbeat mood, and sometimes you can be in a, and you have to learn to kind of, you have to learn to read your own reactions and to be, attempt to be kind of honest about that. I mean, in terms of reassessing films, it happens all the time. And I think the thing that I've mentioned before is that there's a film, was it called either The Golden Dream or The Golden Door, that I had reviewed when it came out, and it was a slow week, and I gave it a very positive review, and then it turned up on Channel 4, and I thought, oh, I like this film. And I started watching it, and I realised that I didn't like it anything like as much as I thought I had, but it was because it was in a week that there wasn't very much interesting, so I had upped my response to it. So the other ones is, obviously, I walked out of Blue Velvet the first time, and then later on I reassessed it and thought it was great. AI is the biggest turnaround for me. But it's also probably true that if I don't like a film, I don't tend to go back and rewatch it unless I absolutely have to, which in the case of AI. In the case of films I like, I mean, I watch Splash a million times and it never disappoints me. But Golden, I think it's either Golden Door, I think it's Golden Door, it's called. I was underwhelmed by the next time round.
Eva says, hi, Team Take. Does Simon realise that this show has now gained extra cult following after he mentioned Taylor Swift among, quotes, incredible musicians in last week's episode?
Okay.
The Swifties salute you. Warm regards from a very long security queue at Denver Airport. Thank you for making it a bit more clear. Oh, there's no question in there, but anyway, I didn't know that, but I think that came up in a question, in terms of current music that you like. I think that was what we were talking about.
Okay.
Temmie in Mild May. What is the most devastating non-swear word insult you've heard?
The most devastating
non-swear word insult that you've heard. So my first thought there went to mudblood in the Harry Potter book. So, I mean, obviously that's fiction as opposed to anything else. But I remember thinking how clever that word was because it managed to be shocking whilst just the creation of J.K. Rowling. So, but you could understand in the context that it was a truly revolting thing to call somebody. We were talking about Nazi adjacent on our take two. And I do think that words matter and the precision of words matters. And sometimes in culture wars, labels are applied, which basically what they're trying to say is you're a fascist.
Mm-hmm.
Without, you know, but it's a very much a blunt instrument. Do you remember when in the Corbyn years, we used to joke about it on the program that anybody who said anything apart from the Dear Leader was a Tory. Tory! You know, you might be listening to some centrist Labour guy, you know. Tory.
I do remember that.
You know what I mean? So, and he was thinking, no, you're just using the word. So when people say fascist or Nazi, you think, fine, as long as you're actually talking about a fascist, don't use that word. And what is it that you're actually trying to imply? But I guess it's a social media thing that it encourages a shorthand. So if there is a pithy word that I can use, which is grossly insulting, then I will use that rather than something which is actually maybe more thoughtful.
Yeah. I think the most, and it's not a word I like, but the most is scab, because I think calling somebody a scab is
it's supposed to be shocking.
No, that's what I mean. But it's not a swear word. But that was what the question was, wasn't it? It was so I think that's the most. And it's a word that you don't use lightly. You shouldn't use lightly, but I'm sure people do. But you know,
It's a good answer because. A devastating non-swear word. That kind of fits.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm thinking now of the scene from Brassed Off in which he says, I'm Coco the Scab. Do you remember that? When he's doing the clown thing and then he starts going off on this and he suddenly, and it's, there is, I mean, the word, everything about the word, the sound of it, the, you know, onomatopoeic sound of it or whatever it is. And then I suppose the other one, because it was, you know, when people say, if there are words that are ever used about you and that they hurt, You know, it's a really odd thing if people call you something, you know, like smug or, you know, thing. And if you've got any sense at all, what you do is you learn to, you know, you learn to, oh, if people think I'm smug, well, you know.
Critics are always called smug. Exactly, right? Exactly. Nature of the job.
And then there was a thing about middle brow. And for a long, I didn't really understand what middle brow meant, but it's, you know, have you ever seen Fish Called Wanda?
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing when Kevin Kline, don't call me stupid. You know, you can call him anything you want, but don't call me stupid. And I've got a real, I think it's partly because when I was at school, I was called stupid quite a lot. I don't think I'm particularly clever, but I really bridle at being called stupid because part of me thinks I am stupid.
Are you a doctor?
Yeah.
Are you a professor?
No, I'm a...
You kind of, you
know. No, I know, but it's funny that even, yes, I've got a PhD, and one of the reasons I've got a PhD is that years later I was still carrying that thing about being called stupid, because I think I am quite dumb in many ways, but it's, you know what I mean? There are just certain things, and I often think of myself like the Kevin Kline character in Fish Called Wanda, don't call me stupid. And the point is, he is stupid. You know, but I do think scab is the...
You know. But also words do hurt. You know, that whole sticks and stones things is rubbish because words can be...
Yes, exactly. Words can be absolutely... It's like, you know, is it okay for somebody to shout fire in a theatre? No. Why? Because that will cause...
Panic.
Or, you know, is it for Donald Trump? Oh, we're recording this the morning after...
We're going to get through an entire recording.
A judge has found him responsible for fraud.
Almost made it.
He is a fraudster and a sexual predator.
Almost.
There we go.
Final. Very, very easy to answer this one. This is from Rob Jones in Dorset. Hi there. Though I'm a first-time email, I can only apologise for not calling myself a long-time listener, as your fantastic show passed me by for many years. For many reasons. I do now have a question that has been itching away. I recently watched, this is a very, 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 very specific question.
Okay.
To which the answer, I believe, is no.
Okay.
I recently watched and adored the Barbie film.
Yes.
And I have to know, has any other film ended on the word gynecologist? And then Rob says, rather pathetically, I think, or perhaps started on it to broaden the discussion. I would think... It would be odd to start anything, any movie with the word gynecologist. You might see it on an office or something. But off the top of your head, Mark, are there any other movies that end with the word gynecologist?
You know, you're going to be shocked to learn that off the top of my head, yes? I can't think of one. But I believe that now we have thrown it open to the audience that somebody, I am sure...
I still think the answer is no.
No. What was the question you asked me not so long ago about, there's songs in which the title is only ever said as the last line of the song. And what were some of the examples?
Well, that was Up
the Junction. And there was three others that were...
The only other one I can think of off the top of my head was George Michael's One More Time. Is that how it finishes? Anyway, mentions it once. That's
okay, but we came up with three. There was three, but it was, and you said one of the things that judges, and I got it because it was. They're all songs that end. It's not just that they end with the title; it's that the only time the title is said is the last.
Yes,
is the last line of
which
the song.
Which is a nice little payoff. It's like a punchline.
Yeah.
However, this will be the only podcast I believe that ends with the word gynecologist.